This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by the Georgia Radio Reading Service, GARS. Hello, I'm Jody Franco bringing you The Week. I'll begin reading from the September 9th and the September 15th issues of The Week, and the first story is one of the main stories, Trump's federal election fraud trial set for March. What happened? The judge overseeing the federal case charging Donald Trump with conspiring to overturn the 2020 election rejected his bid this week to postpone the trial until after the 2024 election, setting a trial date for March 4, 2024. That's one day before Super Tuesday, when 14 states will hold their presidential primaries. Special Prosecutor Jack Smith had requested a January trial, calling that time frame absurd. Trump lawyer John Laurel asked for April 2026, but U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan called that long delay far beyond what was necessary to prepare a defense. She said there's a societal interest to a speedy trial, and that like any other defendant, Trump cannot delay justice because of his professional obligations. Trump called Chutkan a biased, Trump-hating judge and vowed to appeal, though trial dates set by federal judges generally can't be appealed. Last week, Trump surrendered at Fulton County Jail in Atlanta on racketeering charges connected to his efforts to overturn his 2020 loss in the state. He had his mugshot taken, a first for a former president, and was released on $200,000 bail. Former Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, one of 19 co-defenders in the Georgia case, testified for hours in support of an effort to convince a state judge to move his case to a federal courtroom. Meadows is arguing that it belongs there because his attempts to challenge Trump's election loss were part of his official federal duties. Meadows' actions included traveling to and trying to gain access to a ballot audit in suburban Atlanta, and setting up the infamous call in which Trump asked Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to find 11,780 Trump votes. Here's what the editorial said. "What a spectacular mess," said the Wall Street Journal. "Instead of barnstorming states on Super Tuesday, Trump may be stuck in federal courtroom, and how the public will respond is anybody's guess. Some Republicans will be inclined to vote for him just to give a middle finger to an establishment they think is railroading him. But they should recognize that his legal risk or political risk for the GOP, which would be foolish to roll the dice." Good for Chutkan for rejecting Trump's garbage and insisting on a timely trial, said the New York Daily News. As it happens, March 4th has symbolic importance. Through much of U.S. history, it was Inauguration Day. The peaceful transfer of power that took place on that day was a sacred tradition until Trump and his gangsters decided to launch a coup against democracy. Holding them accountable isn't about politics, it's about upholding the rule of law. Here's what the columnist said. "Trump's path to the GOP nomination is littered with court dates," said Kyle Cheney in Politico. "He's a defendant in 7 pending cases, including 3 lawsuits and 4 criminal prosecutions carrying 91 felony counts. Starting next month, when Trump and his business association face trial in a civil suit filed by New York's Attorney General, he'll face a near-constant string of trials, even as he campaigns for the presidency. The New York hush money trial is set for March 25th, while Smith's classified documents trial is scheduled for May 20th. Putting Trump on trial before many of the primaries is a big mistake," said Roth Douthat in the New York Times. "Republican primary voters will have to cast ballots without knowing whether Trump will be convicted. In a recent poll, 45% of GOP voters said they wouldn't support him if he's convicted of a felony. Conducting trials during primaries will only serve to rally Republicans around the candidate perceived to be liberalism's major target." Trump's scowling, instantly ubiquitous mugshot will go down in the history books, said Arwa Madawi in The Guardian. But will it illustrate his demise or his political resurrection? Despite Trump's bombast, multiple felony trials won't help his presidential campaign. And as Trump's legal woes mount, independents are steadily turning against him. It may seem utterly implausible that this lawless, dangerous demagogue may return to the White House, but 2016 taught us to never say never. He may yet make mugs of us all. That article was Trump's Federal Election Fraud Trial Set for March. The next main story is Hurricane Idalia batters the southeast. What happened? Hurricane Idalia barreled across Florida and Georgia this week, turning streets into rivers and ripping off rooftops on its way out to the sea. Idalia made landfall as a Category 3 storm at Big Bend, where the Florida Panhandle meets the peninsula, bringing with it 125-mile-per-hour winds and an 8-foot storm surge. Tampa and St. Petersburg saw near-record floods, while the ocean essentially washed right over the island town of Cedar Key. "My family has been here for many generations," said Cedar Key Mayor Heath Davis. "This storm is worse than we've ever seen." As the hurricane, which slowed down to a Category 1, moved northeast, floodwaters up to 5 feet deep submerged homes, while strong winds toppled trees and power lines, leaving more than 430,000 people without electricity. At least 2 people died in separate rain-related car crashes, and rescue workers fanned out across both states, searching for those stranded in flooded homes. Officials said nearly 1,000 bridges will need to be inspected for storm damage. Another hurricane, Franklin, was also active out in the Atlantic, producing life-threatening rip currents and intensifying Idalia's storm surge on the coast of Georgia and South Carolina. The flooding was made even worse by this week's supermoon, a full moon that exerts a stronger-than-usual gravitational pull and causes higher tides. President Biden said he'd spoken with the governors of all 3 states and promised whatever federal aid was required. "I don't think anybody can deny the impact of the climate crisis now," Biden said. Here's what the columnist said. "In an age of sophisticated weather modeling, it feels like Idalia snuck up on us," said Jeeva Lang in Heat Map. "Exacerbated by climate change, average sea surface temperatures approach 90 degrees in the Gulf of Mexico ahead of the storm. These unlikely warm waters turbocharged Idalia through a process called rapid intensification, in which wind speeds can accelerate by 35 miles per hour in a single day. Climate change may not make hurricanes more frequent, but it does create the conditions for storms that are more intense, slow, and destructive." "We often speak of hurricanes in terms of the physical damage they cause," said Charles Passy in Market Watch, "but they also take a toll on residents' psyches, and the stress they inflict may threaten Florida's popularity. The state has the country's 3rd-largest population, thanks to its reputation as an income tax-free paradise with a Jimmy Buffett-style leave-your-cares-behind vibe. But as a warming world delivers ever more frightening storms, one wonders if Florida will be able to maintain that growth." "All eyes will be on Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in the next few weeks," said Steve Contorno in CNN.com. DeSantis, who's challenging Donald Trump for the Republican presidential nomination, has often invoked his response to last year's Hurricane Ian in his pitch to voters. Primary voters are watching his response to Idalia to see whether he can lead through difficult moments and comfort the aggrieved and, crucially, lay the groundwork for rebuilding. That article was Hurricane Idalia Batters the Southeast. And the last main story today is a racist shooting spree in Jacksonville. What happened? The Justice Department opened a hate crimes investigation this week after a white gunman, using a swastika-adorned rifle, shot 3 black people at a Dollar General in Jacksonville, Florida. Ryan Palmeter, 21, fatally shot Angela Michelle Carr, 52, as she sat in her car outside the store, before entering the building and killing A.J. Laguerre, Jr., a 19-year-old Dollar General employee, and Gerald Gallion, 29. Palmeter then texted his father and told him to go into his room, where he found a suicide note and 20 pages of racist writings. The suspect's family called police. Palmeter was found dead of a self-inflicted gunshot wound when officers arrived at the store. Before the attack, the gunman stopped in the parking lot of the historically black Edward Waters University. He fled after being confronted by campus security. "He targeted a certain group of people, and that's black people," said Jacksonville Sheriff T.K. Waters. "He hated blacks." Palmeter bought his AR-15-style rifle and a handgun legally this year, despite having been placed under a 72-hour psychiatric hold in 2017 for threatening suicide. Under Florida law, such incidents do not appear in background checks unless the person is subsequently committed. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis called the gunman a major league scumbag at a Jacksonville vigil, adding, "We're not going to let people be targeted based on their race." The crowd booed DeSantis, who has sought to curb discussion of racism in public schools and colleges, and a subsequent speaker responded to his remarks. "Respectfully, Governor, he was not a scumbag," said local pastor Jeffrey Rumlin. "He was a racist." Here's what the columnist said. Authorities in Jacksonville claim the shooter was a lone wolf, said Juliet Kayam in The Atlantic, but white supremacists do not act in isolation. They're fueled by an online ecosystem of far-right chat rooms where angry young men study, glorify, and seek to replicate past racist mass killings in Norway, New Zealand, and Texas. Like foreign terror groups, they use violence to publicize their message that whites are still in charge and willing to kill to prove it. DeSantis said the right thing in the wake of the shooting, said the Miami Herald in an editorial, yet the governor's words ring hollow after 2 years of pushing white grievances politics. He's demonized an AP Black Studies course, scared parents about critical race theory, and painted diversity, equity, and inclusion as anti-American. DEI, CRT, and the woke teaching of systemic racism don't kill people. White supremacy does, and it did in mass numbers in Jacksonville, Buffalo, Charleston, El Paso, and Pittsburgh. Meanwhile, the carnage continues, said Nicole Nuria in Vox. So far this year, America suffered at least 476 mass shootings, a term defined as attacks in which four or more people are killed, so Jacksonville is not included. Our gun homicide rate is 26 times that of other high-income countries. Our gun suicide rate nearly 12 times higher. With guns present in 45% of U.S. households and a vocal Republican minority opposed to common-sense firearms regulations, including universal background checks, there's no telling how many people will die. That article was a racist shooting spree in Jacksonville. Next is the controversy of the week. Prigozhin, how his killing will affect Putin's grip on power. The video of Yevgeny Prigozhin's private jet tumbling from a summer sky like a shot bird was viscerally shocking, said The Guardian in an editorial. But his death last week may be the last surprising event in modern Russian history. The plane crash near Moscow, probably the result of a bomb or sabotage, came 2 months after Prigozhin, the thuggish leader of the mercenary Wagner Group that spearheaded the Battle of Bakhmut, staged a mutiny and led a column of tanks and soldiers toward Moscow before suddenly accepting Vladimir Putin's offer of a truce, a pardon, and safe harbor in Belarus. Putin, of course, is denying he assassinated Prigozhin, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. The Russian autocrat offered sincere condolences to the families of those killed last week, including six other Wagner leaders and three flight crew, while faint praising Prigozhin as a talented man with a complex fate who made serious mistakes. But while Russian authorities make a show of investigating the crash, Prigozhin's cause of death couldn't be more obvious if he'd been shot by a firing squad in Red Square. By exacting bloody revenge for his rebellion, Putin has now reasserted his stranglehold on power. Putin has cleared the stage of an impudent rival, said David Ignatius, also in the Post, but his aura of political mastery has been tarnished, perhaps irreparably. The 2 months it took Putin to kill Prigozhin after a near coup suggests indecision and will not erase the Wagner chief's very public critique that the Ukraine war was based on a lie and wasn't worth the terrible cost the nation was paying in blood and treasure. The assassination also further undermines the notion that Russia is a regular state, said The Economist in an editorial. A nation Putin vowed to restore as a great global power has been exposed as a mafia-like enterprise driven by personal whim and blood feuds. From Putin's perspective, that's no contradiction, said Alexander Bonov in Bloomberg. The killing of disloyal associates is a tradition dating back to Joseph Stalin, whom a growing number of Russians regard with respect and even adoration. The brazenness of Prigozhin's murder may be a sign that Putin, a former KGB officer, is ready to give up the democratic window dressing and rule with a Stalin-like iron fist. It's telling that Prigozhin didn't fall out of a window or get poisoned like so many of Putin's foes, said the Washington Examiner in an editorial. The choice to murder him in such a spectacular fashion, along with 9 other people, was Putin's bloody homage to his ruthless KGB and Soviet roots. For other members of Putin's inner circle of oligarchs and elites, said Ann Applebaum in The Atlantic, the assassination is a reminder that they too could be eliminated by their paranoid czar at any time. Some may try to flee overseas rather than wait passively for violence to consume them, but others, especially those who have enough wealth to hire armed bodyguards and private armies, may decide to strike first. Putin could also face revenge from Wagner fighters in the ultranationalists for whom Prigozhin was an icon, said Yulia Litanina in The Hill. Prigozhin's demise leaves potential challengers with 2 lessons. 1, Putin's promises are worthless, and 2, if your tanks are 120 miles from the Kremlin, don't stop. That was the controversy of the week. Prigozhin, how his killing will affect Putin's grip on power. And from a sidebar section entitled Good Week, it's a good week for golfing after former President Donald Trump self-reported his weight as 215 pounds while surrendering to authorities in Fulton County, Georgia. This is down 24 pounds from 2018 when his White House physician claimed the 6'3" Trump weighed 239 pounds, coincidentally just 1 pound shy of technical obesity. And it's a good week for smiles after Japanese scientists announced that they will conduct clinical trials for a pioneering drug that can regrow human teeth, which one researcher called every dentist's dream. Next is the U.S. at a glance. Covington, Kentucky. Another freeze. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell froze for nearly 30 seconds while fielding questions from reporters this week, the second time in as many months that the 81-year-old has become unresponsive during a press conference. Asked about his plans to seek re-election, the Republican stared into the distance before an aide joined him at the lectern and told assembled journalists, "We're going to need a minute." McConnell eventually resumed the press conference but required an aide to repeat questions. In July, McConnell became unresponsive during a gaggle with reporters on Capitol Hill and needed to step away before returning and joking about the incident. McConnell was away from the Senate for 6 weeks earlier this year after falling and suffering a concussion. He's reportedly fallen at least 2 other times this year, raising questions about his fitness for office and that of the elderly leadership in both parties. Next is Chapel Hill, North Carolina, a campus shooting. A University of North Carolina graduate student accused of killing his faculty advisor at a chemistry lab on the Chapel Hill campus was charged with first-degree murder this week. The school was locked down for 3 hours after Tali Key, a second-year grad student, allegedly used a 9mm pistol to fatally shoot Zhijing Yan, an associate professor in the Department of Applied Physical Science. Key, 34, was arrested near his home soon after. Police said they had yet to determine a motive for the attack. Key, a Chinese citizen with a visa to study in the United States, had previously expressed anger in social media posts about women and his faculty advisor. "Bully in America seems to be a problem," he wrote. Professor Yan had recently expressed concern to a colleague about an unnamed grad student who was struggling with mental illness and delusions. And from the world at a glance, Loch Ness, Scotland, monster hunt. The biggest coordinated search in decades for the fabled Loch Ness monster ended this week without finding Nessie. Some 200 enthusiasts, armed with sonar, microphones, and drones, scoped the 23-mile-long lake for signs of the creature, and when one team heard 4 distinctive gloops underwater, we all got a bit excited, search leader Alan McKenna told The Telegraph. Alas, the sounds likely came from ducks. The Loch Ness Monster has been drawing people to the highlands since Robert Wilson released his famous photograph of a dinosaur-like beast in 1934. The photo was later exposed as a hoax, but the myth persisted, and Nessie tourism now generates $52 million a year. Next is Paris. Wine down the drain. Facing a wine surplus that has caused prices to plummet, France is paying farmers to turn their unbottled barrels into distilled alcohol for use in cleaning products and perfume. The government earmarked some $44 million last week on top of $172 million from the EU to compensate French winemakers for destroying nearly 80 million gallons of wine. Thanks to a growing taste for beer, coupled with the closure of many wine bars during the pandemic, wine consumption is down 15% so far this year. We're producing too much, and the sale price is below the production price, so we're losing money, said winemaker Jean-Philippe Grenier. France has also begun paying vineyards to rip out their vines and find more profitable uses for the land. Next is Kobe City, Japan, death from overwork. A young doctor was driven to suicide after working 207 hours of overtime in a single month, his family said last month. Takashima Shingo, 26, a medical resident at Konan Medical Center in Kobe City, hadn't taken a day off in 3 months, including weekends. Driven to desperation, he told his family before his death in May that it was too hard and no one would help him. The hospital denied the accusations, but a government probe ruled Shingo's death a work-related incident. Brutal hours are such a problem in Japan that there's a word for death by overwork, karoshi. A recent report found that 20% of Japanese doctors work more than 80 hours of overtime a month, the threshold for risk of karoshi. Next is the briefing of the week on capturing carbon. The U.S. is investing in technologies that keep CO2 out of industrial emissions or that remove it from the atmosphere. What is carbon capture? With greenhouse gas emissions continuing to rise, politicians and scientists are looking at capturing carbon dioxide as a potential solution to help reach net zero emissions. The Biden administration just announced a $1.2 billion investment in two carbon capture projects in Texas and Louisiana, its first major investment in the burgeoning carbon removal industry. Carbon capture aims to trap the CO2 released by power plants and factories and keep it from reaching the atmosphere, either by sequestering it underground or recycling it in the plants. For most of human history, nature has provided its own form of carbon capture. Trees absorb carbon dioxide through the process of photosynthesis, but human civilization is now producing far more CO2 than trees can handle. Is carbon capture new? The idea has been around since at least the 1980s, but it's not yet done on a large scale. That would require a steep rise in government funding. A recent report found that carbon removal technologies would need to increase by a factor of 1,300 by 2050 to limit global temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The Paris Climate Agreement's increasingly unlikely target is 1.5 degrees. No matter how fast we decarbonize the nation's economy, we must tackle the legacy pollution already in our atmosphere to avoid the worst effects of climate change, said Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm. How does it work? There are two types of carbon capture, post-combustion and direct air. The former is the primary method of currently used in the United States. It takes emissions from smokestacks at power plants and factories and separates out the CO2. Direct air capture, instead, uses a machine that sucks in vast amounts of air, like a vacuum, and then extracts the carbon with chemicals. The CO2 then gets pressurized into liquid form and transported by pipelines to be used or stored. It can go toward commercial purposes, carbonating drinks, for example, or get recycled back into the energy industry. If sequestered, the carbon is injected into a dense rock layer at least 2,600 feet below ground so that the CO2 doesn't leak out. Is this process expensive? Very. Direct air capture is currently too expensive and energy intensive to work on a large scale. There are only 18 direct air capture plants currently operating in the world. But the Biden administration plans to invest $3.5 billion in direct air capture hubs. The World Resources Institute estimates that direct air capture costs from $250 to $600 per metric ton of CO2. But even at $100 per metric ton, It would cost about $780 billion to lower the atmospheric concentration of CO2 by just one part per million. The atmosphere CO2 concentration is now about 420 parts per million, well past 350, the level at which scientists think we can hold global average temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius. So major technological breakthroughs are needed for carbon capture to become a truly useful tool. Scientists at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory recently discovered a new technique for capturing the carbon produced in power plants that cost only $39 per metric ton, the cheapest ever reported in a peer-reviewed journal. What are the downsides? Some scientists and environmentalists argue that carbon capture may distract from the goal of reducing emissions and offers an out to energy companies that want to continue burning fossil fuels. Oil and gas companies actually lobbied for carbon capture funding to be included in the 2021 infrastructure bill. Plus, the carbon capture process itself produces emissions. A 2019 study found that widespread carbon capture would lower Earth's net emissions by only 10 to 11% once the energy used to capture the carbon was taken into account. There are also environmental and safety risks that come with building new pipelines to transport CO2. If you're doing too little on the emissions mitigation side, said Glenn Peters of Norway's Center for International Climate Research, then there's no point of carbon dioxide removal. So why do it? Most scientists agree that reaching a safe level of carbon in the atmosphere will be incredibly difficult without using carbon capture. Transitioning to renewable energy sources alone may not be enough. The two projects funded by Biden's investment are expected to capture more than 2 million metric tons of CO2 annually, equal to eliminating almost 500,000 gas cars. The International Energy Agency says that carbon capture could eventually lower global CO2 emissions by almost a fifth and decrease the overall cost of minimizing climate change by 70%. There's no 100% solution, said Howard Herzog of MIT's Energy Initiative. We need a lot of 10 and 20% solutions, and this is one of them. That was a briefing entitled Capturing Carbon. Next are two of the best columns in the United States this week. First, from David French in the New York Times, Christians Who Love to Hate. Christianity is being distorted into a justification for hatred and violence, said David French. The man who shot and killed California shop owner Laura Ann Carlton last month for displaying a rainbow pride flag frequently reposted online messages about calling on Jesus when your heart is hurting and the tears fall. He mixed his messages about Christianity with images of burning pride flags and denunciations of LGBTQ people as literally demonic. As an evangelical Christian, I found this juxtaposition chilling, especially because I hear the shooter's hatred of LGBTQ people from right-wing Christians all the time. In the Trump era, many evangelicals have embraced a form of political Christianity that bears little resemblance to the faith as described in the Bible. This religiously flavored authoritarianism focuses on attacking external enemies and celebrates threats and violence. The teachings of the New Testament and Jesus were clear. Beware the hateful, the people drawn to strife. Embrace those who are kind and peaceful. Love our neighbors as we love ourselves. But American political Christianity is angry and punitive and positively delights in strife. This religious war is pushing our national divide to the boiling point. That was from David French in the New York Times, Christians Who Love to Hate. And next by Dan Coyce in Slate.com, Near Misses at the Airports. American air travel has become shockingly safe with no fatal commercial airline crashes since 2009, said Dan Coyce. But the next big crash is coming. A New York Times report revealed last week that near-miss incidents at airports and runways have doubled over the past decade, with three in July alone. One database identified 300 reported incidents of near collisions involving commercial airlines over the past year, with some planes passing within feet of each other on overcrowded runways. Pilots and air traffic controllers say that everyone's bracing for catastrophe. For 3 million people flying in the United States every day, 310 of the nation's 313 air traffic control facilities are understaffed, and controllers are hideously overworked. Many work 6 days per week. Pilots are in short supply, too, after airlines offered buyouts during the pandemic, and they're hiring newcomers with less flight experience. Only 43 of the nation's more than 500 commercial airports have surface detection systems to alert controllers that planes are on collision courses. As a result, near-fatal crashes are becoming frighteningly commonplace. The FAA and the airlines have been pushing their luck, and if nothing changes, it won't be long until that luck runs out. That was Near Misses at the Airport by Dan Coy in Slate.com. And two of the best columns in Europe this week. First from Greece, the Elgin Marbles are not safe in Britain. The British Museum can no longer be trusted to protect Greek treasures, said George Soukalos. As a private detective who has devoted his life to hunting down plunderers, I was outraged and incensed to learn last week that ancient Greek jewelry and coins were among some 2,000 items stolen from the museum since 2016. In a shocking display of impunity and laxity, the museum did nothing when dealers warned it years ago that items from its collection were turning up on eBay. The museum is now blaming a curator, a world expert on ancient Greece, for the thefts, but he seems to be just one cog in a trafficking ring that smuggled the objects to black market dealers and sold faithful forgeries online as decoys. We may never recover those artifacts, but it's not too late to save the Elgin Marbles, the sculptures that a brazen British ambassador chiseled off the Parthenon 2 centuries ago. For decades, Greece has pressured Britain to return the marbles, but the Brits refused, claiming that preservation and display facilities at the British Museum were of a higher standard than anything our country could offer. That excuse was always offensive. Now it's laughable. It's time to go to the international court and demand that the looters return what they stole. That was The Elgin Marbles Are Not Safe in Britain by George Soukalos from Greece. And next from the United Kingdom, the country ruled by grannies. A secret cabal controls British politics and Robert Coville, but it's not some shadowy network of global elites. It's your Nan's Bridge Club. Time and again, on decision after decision, our politicians put the elderly first. While the country suffers through inflation and a recession, older Brits keep getting handouts, from gold-plated pension increases to subsidies for their winter fuel bills. Their millennial grandchildren, meanwhile, are crushed by student loans and some of the world's highest child care costs, and shut out from homeownership by hilariously unaffordable housing. The explanation for this disparity in treatment is obvious. It's the elderly who vote. Politicians have little incentive to push for more housing or cheaper child care if their constituents don't demand it. But we ignore these problems at everyone's peril. The Office for National Statistics recently announced that the fertility rate for British-born women plunged 22% in the past decade, an astonishing decline. Young people apparently feel so glum about their prospects that they're delaying starting families or dropping the idea altogether. Such pessimism presents a slow-moving disaster for the country. Without new youngsters to enter the workforce and pay into pension funds, we risk the whole generational Ponzi scheme toppling over. That article was from the United Kingdom, A Country Ruled by Grannies, by Robert Coville in the Sunday Times. And next, our talking points. First, the GOP debate, an elephant in the room. The winner of the first GOP primary debate was a no-show, said Scott Jennings in the Los Angeles Times. Last week's debate left conservatives like me wondering if these eight candidates have any realistic plan to take down former President Trump, who said he has no intention of lowering himself to spar with contenders he leads in polls by 40 points. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis may have stabilized his foundering campaign with prepackaged tough talk about shooting drug smugglers stone cold dead at the border, but he didn't produce the breakout performance he needed to consolidate the non-Trump field. Former Vice President Mike Pence offered an energetic and feisty performance aimed squarely at the Christian conservatives of Iowa. And former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley supplanted a listless Chris Christie as the principal anti-Trump foil on the stage, warning voters The multiply indicted MAGA King was the most disliked politician in all of America. Biotech entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy was a slick-talking attention hog, leaving viewers either energized or appalled with his insistence that fixing a broken America isn't complicated, guys. The ensemble performance was surreal, said Dana Milbach in the Washington Post. Trump's rivals mostly dodged questions about the heavy favorite and instead chose to emulate him. Five candidates even wore matching Trump red ties. If the viable alternatives are all Trump cheerleaders, why wouldn't voters just go with a genuine article rather than one of his sycophants? DeSantis epitomizes this problem, said Philip Klein in National Review. Post-debate polls showed him and Ramaswamy getting small bumps, but not nearly enough to make Trump sweat. DeSantis came across as way too calculating and cautious. When the candidates were asked if they'd support Trump as the nominee if he's convicted of a crime, six of the eight candidates raised their hands. DeSantis looked around for a few seconds before half raising his hand. When the candidates were asked whether they would oppose future Ukraine aid, DeSantis' hand went up partially. He dodged a question about Pence's role on January 6th and chided the Fox News moderator for asking candidates to take a clear stance on climate change. With such a huge deficit to overcome, DeSantis does not have the luxury to play it safe. Ramaswamy's cocky, know-it-all persona pushed the robotic DeSantis into the background, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. The 38-year-old Yale Law School grad smugly dismissed climate change as a hoax, said the U.S. should stop sending weapons to Ukraine, and promised to dismantle most of the federal government. He came off as an exaggerated version of a familiar type, the callow and condescending nerd who assumes that skill in one field translates to aptitude in all others. So why is this smug political neophyte now enjoying a bizarre surge to third place in GOP polls? As an Indian American, Ramaswamy delights older white conservatives by telling them the only remaining racism in America comes from the left. Sadly, my party has now adopted a culture that rewards incentivizes Trumpian behavior, said Matt Lewis in the Daily Beast. Candidates who get noticed have no sense of shame. Traits like decency, merit, and consistency become liabilities. Former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson is too decent, read, boring, to win, but the cocky and fast-talking Ramaswamy is perfectly suited to thrive. Haley was an exception, said Noah Rothman in National Review, making the genuinely courageous decision to treat Republican debate watchers like adults. She advocated finding a national consensus on abortion, noting that Republicans will never achieve a filibuster-proof Senate majority to pass a federal abortion ban. She criticized Trump administration spending that added $8 trillion to the national debt, and vigorously defended U.S. support for Ukraine and condemned Vladimir Putin as a thug and murderer. Finally, she warned Republicans that Trump is going to spend more time in a courtroom next year than he is campaigning, weakening his chances of beating the incumbent Joe Biden. But it remains to be seen whether there's a market for sanity and realism in today's GOP. I doubt it, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. The GOP has mutated into a political party, into an angry, unfocused, sometimes violent, countercultural movement. Members signal tribal solidarity by hating whatever progressives and Reagan conservatives like me support. Ukraine? To hell with them. Government agencies? Disband them. Donald Trump? Pardon him. With a few exceptions, the debate was an exercise in moral cowardice. But it probably doesn't matter. It seems increasingly inevitable that Trump will be the GOP nominee, and none of the people at the debate in Milwaukee had a clue what to do about that. That article was GOP Debate, An Elephant in the Room. The next talking point is Musk, his growing power over government. The U.S. government is dangerously beholden to Elon Musk, said Ronan Farrow in The New Yorker. The billionaire's rocket company, SpaceX, is currently the sole means by which NASA can get astronauts into space from U.S. soil. Another venture, Tesla, controls the country's biggest network of electric vehicle charging stations, giving it an outsized say in transportation and energy policy. Musk's Starlink satellite internet service, meanwhile, is crucial to defense policy. Pentagon officials were forced to plead with the tech mogul last fall after some Ukrainian units lost access to Starlink, their main battlefield of communication tool, while fighting Russian forces. Musk had earlier demanded that the U.S. pay for Ukraine's discounted Starlink service and had started pushing a pro-Russia peace plan, apparently dreamed up after one-on-one talks with President Vladimir Putin. The U.S. later struck a deal on Starlink, but officials remain uneasy about their reliance on Musk. "We're living off his good graces," said a Pentagon official. "That sucks." Musk has unprecedented power in his hands, said Peter Sathe in The Wrap, and those hands seem shakier and more erratic each day. Look at his disastrous efforts to remake X, formerly known as Twitter. Since buying the social media company for $44 billion last year, he's alienated advertisers and users by letting hate speech flourish and by firing staffers responsible for maintaining critical infrastructure. Could drug use be responsible for Musk's increasingly bizarre behavior? Asked Jonathan Last in The Bulwark. Musk associates suggested to Farrow that the billionaire, a workaholic who struggles with loneliness and stress, has upped his use of ketamine in recent years. A depression treatment and party drug, ketamine can feed impulsiveness and feelings of grandeur. So, U.S. policy is heavily dependent on a man who may or may not have his judgment heavily influenced by pharmaceuticals. Cool. Cool. For now, the government is stuck with Musk, said Tim Finholtz in Quartz. It spent billions of dollars trying to build Boeing and Blue Origin into private alternatives to SpaceX, but those firms have repeatedly failed to deliver. But relying on one person with erratic behavior and connections to authoritarian foreign governments, Tesla produces half its cars in China, is a real problem. SpaceX is dependent on government funding, and officials should be bolder in using that as leverage. Still, until a serious rival to Musk emerges, this risky codependency will continue. That article was Musk, his growing power over government. And the final talking point today is travel. Why tourists are behaving badly. This feels like the summer of bad tourists, said Natalie Compton in the Washington Post. Across Europe and beyond, entitled travelers have gone rogue, grabbing headlines with their vandalism, tantrums, and narcissism. There's the woman who shocked Romans last month by climbing across the venerated Trevi Fountain to fill her water bottle. The Bulgarian man who scratched his girlfriend's name into the 2,000-year-old Colosseum. And the two drunk Americans who recently slept off a heavy night in Paris's Eiffel Tower. Visitors have damaged unique geological landforms in China, belly-flopped into Venice's canals, and horrified locals in Bali by getting drunk, naked, and violent. Tourist acting out is nothing new, but many behaviorists and travel industry veterans think things are getting worse. More travelers feel they should be able to do whatever they want, said cultural studies researcher Kirsty Sedgman, never mind manners, rules, and social norms. Fed-up tourist hotspots are pushing back, said Leibowit Lily Gurma in Bloomberg. Bali has closed off some sacred sites to tourists and ramped up deportations, sending hundreds packing this summer. Officials in the overrun Croatian city of Dubrovnik started a campaign to discourage behaviors such as parading through the historic city center in bathing suits and dragging wheeled suitcases across cobblestone streets, which generates a click-click-click noise that torments locals. In picturesque Portofino, Italy, selfie-taking tourists who obstruct traffic are subject to fines. Some destinations have taken more creative measures, said Chris Livesey in CBSNews.com. In Spain, locals have posted signs at beaches warning of fake dangers like jellyfish and falling rocks. A number of forces are at work here, said Larry Blyberg in BBC.com. Tourists eager to make up for lost pandemic years are deluging cities with a revenge travel mentality, dictating that no whim should be denied. Desperation for social media likes leads some people to extreme behaviors, such as stripping down in public. But social media is also a vehicle for calling out problem travelers, and that's a good thing. With each new report of cringe-worthy, tone-deaf, or just plain disrespectful behavior, our collective outrage seems to be rising, creating a moment of reckoning for bad tourists. This shaming drives home an important message we should all heed. International travel is a privilege, and privilege brings responsibility. That was Travel, Why Tourists Are Behaving Badly. And from a poll watch, 77% of Americans say that Joe Biden, 80, is too old to effectively serve another 4 years as president, including 69% of Democrats and 89% of Republicans. 51% of Americans think that the 77-year-old Donald Trump is too old to serve another term, including 71% of Democrats and 28% of Republicans. And from a sidebar section, Donald Trump's campaign raised $7.1 million in the first 48 hours after he was booked in an Atlanta jail. That includes $4.18 million raised the day after the booking, the highest one-day total for the campaign, which is marketing shirts, bumper stickers, and beverage coolers adorned with Trump's mugshot and the tagline, "Never Surrender," of people convicted of trafficking fentanyl. In 2022, 89% were U.S. citizens, according to a Cato Institute analysis. The vast majority of fentanyl and other drugs is smuggled in vehicles at legal checkpoints. Just 0.009% of migrants apprehended at the border were carrying any fentanyl. And from a business column, lockdown, stores struggle to deter rising thefts. Retailers are blaming rampant shoplifting for their shrinking bottom lines, said Hamza Shaban in Yahoo.com. In waves of earnings calls last week, major store chains like Dick's Sporting Goods, Target, Macy's, Home Depot, and Dollar Tree took pains to mention the theme of missing merchandise in hits to their quarterly profits. Videos of brazen smash-and-grab looting operations, sometimes involving hundreds of masked individuals, appear in the news almost weekly, adding to the sense of lawlessness. Retailers lost $94.5 billion in 2021, nearly double the amount from 2018, to inventory shrink, an industry term that refers to lost or stolen merchandise. More retailers are responding by putting items in locked cases and even taking often stolen items out of the stores. These attacks are not carried out by small groups of petty criminals, said Stephen Malaga in City Journal. There's a sophisticated illicit infrastructure underpinning this activity that's about reselling stolen goods for profit. The merchandise is sold by operators online where they are hard to detect or track down. Often, it winds up on large anonymous marketplaces like Amazon and eBay. The illegal industry includes cleaners who strip goods of security devices and money launderers who process the transactions. But enabling this behavior are the states that have decriminalized low-level shoplifting under the misconception that most thieves have turned to stealing to put food on the table. More than two-thirds of states now treat shoplifting as a misdemeanor if the value boosted is less than $1,000. Retailers aren't helping when they refer to this problem with jargon like shrink, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Plain language about theft rather than the euphemism would make the public better understand how bad the problem is and build support for policies that would do something about it. Shrink is a purposely vague term, said Gabrielle Fonrouge in CNBC.com. Companies say repeatedly that organized theft drove shrink without explicitly breaking down how much of the inventory loss is due to crime or how it's changed over time. Shrink can just as easily be explained by employee theft, administrative error, and inventory damage. In fact, internal pilfering has traditionally been the largest contributor to shrink, since retail employees have access to entire cases of merchandise in back rooms or warehouses. But it's easier to blame gangs of criminals than to admit to having internal challenges or poor hiring practices. And finally, shoplifting hurts more than just profits, said Stacy Torres in the Los Angeles Times. Shopping at Target or the supermarket used to be my happy place, but locked glass cabinets safeguarding merchandise are now ubiquitous. It's demoralizing to have to ask a clerk to retrieve your deodorant. At my local Safeway, you have to enter through an automatic gate rigged with alarms if you try to exit the same way. Companies say these measures are there to make us all feel safer, but to me, they make me feel like visiting a prison. That article was Lockdown, Stores Struggle to Deter Rising Thefts. Next, the obituary section. The host who invited us to come on down. Bob Barker, 1923 to 2023. When he stepped down after 18 years as host of the game show Truth or Consequences in 1975, Bob Barker was recognized by Guinness as television's most durable performer. That was just a warm-up. He shredded that record in its next role, spending 35 years as host of the CBS game show The Price is Right. With his resonant baritone and perpetual tan, the affable host was a daytime TV institution, exhorting generations of contestants to come on down, to guess the prices of cars, appliances, and groceries. By his retirement in 2007, Barker had presided over more than 6,500 episodes, won 19 Emmys, and become a master of banter. "Can I kiss you?" a woman on the show once asked. "No, I'm working," he deadpanned. "Meet me in the parking lot later." Born in Darrington, Washington, Barker was raised on a South Dakota Indian reservation, where his widowed mother taught school, said the Hollywood Reporter. He trained as a Navy fighter pilot and married his high school sweetheart before studying economics at Drury College in Springfield, Missouri. To pay his way, he read news and sports on a local radio station. When the host of an audience participation show failed to show up, Barker filled in and found his calling, working at stations in Florida and L.A. The producer of Truth or Consequences soon heard him on the radio and invited him to audition for television. Barker charmed audiences with his quips and plain-spoken style, said CBSNews.com. Offered the host job on The Price is Right in 1972, he did both shows for 2 years before Price became his focus. In 1996, he impressed a new audience with a memorable scene in Happy Gilmore, in which, playing himself, he beat up Adam Sandler's character. In later years, Barker gained national attention for his animal rights activism, said the Washington Post. A vegetarian, he unfailingly closed The Price is Right by asking viewers to spay and neuter their pets, and he quit his gig hosting the Miss USA pageant after 21 years because producers refused to stop giving fur coats as prizes. Trim and fit well into his senior years, he finally retired at 83. TV hosts are like pies, and some people like apple and some cherry, he said in 2009. I'm just very fortunate that they like me well enough to invite me into their homes for 50 years. Next is the obituary for David Jacobs, 1939 to 2003, the Dallas creator who livened up evening TV. David Jacobs brought the soap opera to prime time. When the screenwriter developed Dallas in the 1970s, evening TV shows were made up of self-contained episodes that wrapped up neatly each week. Dallas, though, borrowed a format from daytime soaps, using multi-episode story arcs that required a loyal audience to tune in for each installment. When it premiered on CBS in 1978, it quickly hooked viewers on the trashy saga of Texas oil baron J.R. Ewing and his scheming family as they double-cross one another in a world of wealth and power. For 3 seasons, Dallas was number one. It ran for 14 seasons. The show depicted a time when American values were terribly screwed up, Jacob said. I think Dallas was trying, at least in my head and heart, to show that. It was never trying to glorify that world. Born in working-class Baltimore to a cabbie father, Jacob studied art in college, but recognized that he wasn't talented enough to make a living as a painter, said the New York Times. He moved to New York in hopes of becoming a novelist, spending over a decade writing everything from children's encyclopedia entries to biographies. After a divorce, he moved to Los Angeles and began writing on shows, and an executive offered him a deal to create his own series. By its second season, Dallas was a certified smash and a cultural phenomenon, said Deadline. At the end of the third season, the Who Shot J.R. plotline transfixed the nation for months, and betting parlors worldwide took wagers on the identity of the shooter. After Dallas and its spinoff, Knott's Landing, concluded in the 1990s, Jacobs created more shows, but he never equaled the success of his early series, said The Guardian. He disclaimed responsibility for what fans always call the show's biggest blunder, resurrecting the character of Bobby Ewing, J.R.'s brother, who'd been killed off in season 8. He recalled the entirety of season 9 as one long nightmare of Bobby's wife. I thought it was a terrible idea, Jacob said. I thought it would negate the emotion of Bobby's death. People have a very willing suspension of disbelief, but I don't think they want to be jerked around too much. That was the obituary for the Dallas creator, David Jacobs. And from the travel section, a trove of shark teeth in Texas. North Texas is a fossil hunter's paradise, said Rose Catalan in Texas Monthly. During the Cretaceous period, when dinosaurs roamed the earth, a shallow sea covered much of the Lone Star State, and today it's easy to find the fossilized remains of ammonites, sea lilies, and other ancient life in Texas's public stream beds. You just have to know where to look. Recently, a Google Maps pin simply labeled shark teeth led my husband and me to Post Oak Creek, a modest waterway north of Dallas. Using a homemade sieve, we sifted through wet sediment. The routine was calming, even meditative. Scoop pebbles in, shake the sieve, sift through by hand, dump it all out, repeat. Downstream, children splashed around as they searched for the fangs of prehistoric predators with genus names such as Galagadon. Eventually, I spotted a serrated 1.5-inch specimen, and our sifting quickly turned up another 20 teeth. Back home, we marveled at our haul. It's mind-boggling to hold in your hand a tooth from around 100 million years ago and imagine a world that looked utterly different. That was a trove of shark teeth in Texas. And from the health and science section, babies need faces, not screens. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends zero screen time for babies. A new study strengthens that case, linking daily screen time for one-year-olds to delayed development in toddlerhood. The Japanese survey followed more than 7,000 new mothers for 4 years, asking them about their baby's daily exposure to screens, TV, video games, tablets, and smartphones, and the children's developmental milestones. About 51% said they allowed their one-year-olds 1 or up to 4 hours on screens. The following year, those children were more likely to struggle with communication and problem-solving skills. The children of the 4% of mothers who allowed babies more than 4 hours of screen time a day were nearly 5 times as likely to experience communication delays. In-person parental or caregiver interaction imparts crucial information about language, expressions, and the physical environment to babies that doesn't happen when you're watching the screen, Yale developmental psychologist David J. Lukowitz tells the New York Times. Talk to your child as much as you can, face to face. That concludes today's readings from the September 8th and September 15th issues of the week. This has been Jody Franco for the Georgia Radio Reading Service. Thank you for listening to GARS.